Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We recently announced a $1.2 billion commitment from the Commodity Credit Corporation to expand opportunities to diversify our reach.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The sad reality for American agriculture is that we've put too much emphasis on a handful of markets in terms of agricultural exports. Roughly, our top four or five markets basically are responsible for nearly 60% of our exports. And so we believe it's important and necessary for us to figure out ways in which we can expand the number of market opportunities and increase our commitment to those that are not in the top four or five. So this $1.2 billion commitment, about $1.1 billion is going to be utilized to expand assistance to our cooperators to be able to go out in these new market opportunities and to invest and to provide promotions and presence to encourage American agriculture opportunities there.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Chinese economy using one out of every three bales in the world. We've got to keep an eye on them.
The past 10 years, trade has been all about China. Kevin Brinkley, CEO, Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
They've actually had some really big defaults or almost defaults in huge property sectors there. And 80% of household wealth in China is tied up in real estate. So huge impact on what they're able to do. Some more things to consider. Prices trading below 80 cents. That discretionary spending, again, gets limited by higher interest rates. And we're just going to look at some of these numbers really quick. This is not a spread that you want to see. The orange line is credit card debt. The blue line is personal savings. You saw where personal savings jumped way up when the government made a bunch of direct payments. Now they have spent through most of that money and are using the plastic. Auto loan delinquencies. This is not a problem that I expected to see this quickly, but you got folks that are at least a couple of months behind on their car payments. Has risen to over 6%. It's been back to 1994 since it was that high. Not a good leading indicator. And also, the interest rates have jumped up as well with the higher rates overall.
With lower cotton prices, lower than break even, what could be acreage in the U.S. next year?
Our grain stocks have been down for the past 3 years, and USDA is projecting a significant rise, particularly in corn, for the coming year. And so what's this going to do to prices out there? So if you look at commodities that generally trended lower, this is the cotton price index from January 1st of 2020. We just kind of picked that date. It was before COVID actually started. To index these prices, we had a mighty move up there that you can see in 2022, but our prices have been fairly range-bound for the past several months. If you add in other commodities, we've got corn here, also in the last couple of months, very range-bound in its trading, and the same for soybeans. Soybeans, obviously not a big deal here, but you have to think about the massive number of acres in the Delta Eastern territories that are planted to a variety of crops. And soybeans are certainly an impact on cotton acres for the U.S. And then, of course, wheat, if I can get that one to come up. Wheat has suffered at the hands of lots of things, building stocks, and probably not as attractive as it once was. Again, these are all kind of giving you relative strength to one another. So what is a grower going to do about the upcoming season? If we were planning now, here in November, which we're not, but you have to take the data that you know about. This is what you get when you divide the price of a competing crop by the price of cotton today. And amazingly, cotton is not the worst commodity up here. It's wheat today. But soybeans would be the clear winner. And again, if this persists into the spring planting season, we believe that you will see a lot of acres shift in the mid-south and the southeast into soybeans. It's a cheap crop to grow. Their yields have been phenomenal the last two seasons on both corn and soybeans in the mid-south. So soybeans would kind of be the winner. If it siphons some acres off in those territories in the eastern United States, that could strengthen our prices here and perhaps draw some more incentive to plant cotton here. It has just been a tough time in the cotton business, and we realize this, and we look every day for ways to add value to the crop.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We must overturn the CFPB's small business lending rule to ensure small businesses across America, who are the backbone of our country, have continued access to affordable credit to support and grow our economy.
Representative Roger Williams from Texas is chairman of the House Small Business Committee.
Access to affordable credit is key to ensuring communities across America remain vibrant. Unfortunately, the CFPB's small business lending rule undermines the goal of affordable and available credit, which I think we all should share. Here's why. First, the CFPB's rule is overly broad. It will require lenders to collect massive amounts of data whenever a small business owner applies for credit. Most of the information is unnecessary to make a fair, equitable, safe, and sound loan. Requiring lenders to provide the information infringes on small business owners' rights to privacy about their personal and business information when applying for credit. Second, the CFPB's rule is burdensome. Community banks and credit unions across America account for the majority of small business lending. They are doing their part. Despite claims from my colleagues across the aisle, this rule does not go after big banks. It will have the biggest impact on the small community financial institutions already operating under the thinnest of margins because of runaway inflation, increased interest rates, the Federal Reserve, in general, the Biden economy. The rule also discourages banks and credit unions from expanding their lending portfolios. They might simply decide that the droves of new compliance officers they would have to hire to comply with this onerous rule would simply not be worth it, and Main Street is hammered again. The CFPB director says he is trying to be sensitive to the needs of small community financial institutions, oftentimes advocating for relationship banking. However, in the rule, the CFPB sets the transaction threshold at an incredibly low 100 loans in the preceding two calendar years. This means the smallest of banks, small business, and their owners will be the ones to bear the brunt of the unnecessary data collections, and Main Street is hammered again. Third, the rule will be difficult to implement. The rule itself is nearly 900 pages and requires lenders to report 81 data fields. Developing compliance systems to achieve this will be extremely costly for firms, which takes resources away from actually lending to small business, and Main Street is hammered again. The timeline for implementation is also insufficient for lenders to develop the necessary systems to comply with such a complex and burdensome regulation. Each hour a lender spends on the overly broad data collection demanded by the rule is an hour not devoted to ensuring credit is available and affordable for small business, and Main Street is hammered again. So finally, it's unclear that the Bureau intends to do with its exceedingly expansive data demands. What we do know is the CFPB plans to publicly post the data on the CFPB's website. This is concerning given the Bureau's alarming record of facilitating the naming and shaming of companies whose business activities progressive activists want to attack. Adding to the concerns of the CFPB's abysmal track record of protecting the highly sensitive data it already collects. And in fact, back in February of this year, there was a major unauthorized data breach by the CFPB employee, which included personally identifiable information and confidential supervisory information. So why should we ever trust them to protect sensitive information of small business owners this time around? So to sum it up, the rule is backwards looking. It's anti-small business. It's anti-capitalism. It's anti-competition. It's anti-free markets. And it's anti-risk and reward. It is critical we pass this resolution to overturn this reckless CFPB rule to protect small business access to the credit needed to continue to innovate and grow our economy. And, oh, a new idea while we're at it, let's put people back to work again.
Legislation did pass the House, now on to the Senate. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Kicking off Thursday, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP28, in the United Arab Emirates. One of the key points of emphasis at this latest COP, agriculture's role as a climate mitigator. And among those providing voice to ag in Dubai, National Farmers Union President Rob LaRue.
Farmers and ranchers are a big part of the solution also on mitigating the impacts here. So there are a lot of reasons to make sure that farmers' voice is in this conversation.
And although
officially we will be observers of the proceedings,
LaRue and NFU are also an active part of international farm representation at COP28. That includes delegates for the World Farmer Organization, participants of sessions focused on climate-smart practices such as regenerative ag, and dialogue with the COP28 farmer constituency. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
Kansas State University entomologists have been working with nanotechnology in hopes of finding a way to reduce pesticide use while making it longer lasting. K-State nanoentomologist Amy Norton discusses previous work that has been done with this technology and the process for working with that small of materials. She first describes the size of a nanoparticle with a comparison.
When you're thinking about nanoparticle, it's very small. It's between 1 nanometer and 100 nanometer. And, you know, when we think about that, it's something that it's really hard to grasp. So if you think of the Earth as a meter, comparing the Earth to a tennis ball, the tennis ball would be 1 nanometer. And so that size ratio is what we're looking at here. And so when we look at our particles and our particles in different mediums, like finding them in tracking them in insects and stuff, we're using special microscopes and special equipment. And so everything is very, we have to use electronic microscopes, and really we can't see it by eye.
Norton has done previous nanotechnology work with mosquitoes that will be beneficial moving forward.
For the mosquitoes, we created this hybrid material, and what that means is we put two materials in one. So we had a micro particle made out of Zn, and what that means is that the micro was slightly bigger, so it was about 300 nanometers, and then we put on silver nanoparticles, which were about 20 nanometers in size, and so we attached that to the outside, and then we put it into water, and we allowed the mosquito larva to filter feed in the water, and we could go down to one part per million and kill 90% of the mosquitoes.
She explains a process of her work and the technology that is used to make it possible.
First, we synthesize the material, and then we have to characterize that the material are there. And so first, we look at the size of the materials. We use this instrument called a dynamic light scattering. And so what you do is you basically shoot a laser at the material. And then depending on the particle size, the laser will come out at different angles. And depending on that angle, you can determine the size. And then the other thing we do is we image the particles. And so we use a scanning electron microscope, and we use a transmitting electron microscope. And those can look at very nanometer size. And basically what they're doing is they're shooting electrons down, and then the electrons reflect back and come up with an image.
That was K-State nanoentomologist Amy Norton. She says they plan on using natural biodegradable materials for their work as they move forward. I'm Shelby Varner.
Thanks, Shelby. You're listening to our comprehensive look at agribusiness, news, markets, and weather. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
COVID of the past 3 years actually helped remind people maybe where their food comes from.
Tom Sell with Combass Sell and Associates.
They became foodies, right? They all started cooking in the house and buying more fresh ingredients to make their concoctions. And it reconnected in some way the public to our food systems. They also, I think, when considering runs on the grocery store on things like toilet paper and other essential goods like that, it made them appreciate just the bounty that we know as a nation. And that's thanks to the men and women, the families that farm the land around this country, the most dynamic, the most productive agricultural sector in the world currently. And certainly we have a food system that produces the most safe, affordable, abundant, diverse food supply in the history of mankind.
He also talks about skeptics.
Skeptics are currently gaining ground. This is a time in Washington, D.C., where skeptics can always have a voice, not only in Washington, D.C., but in our public circles with our iPhones and everything else. The skeptics they get a lot of likes. They get a lot of views on the social media. And they're gaining ground again in agriculture. And we always face skeptics on agricultural policy. It's one of the challenges I've faced since the time that I went up there. There just aren't many of us in agriculture. Of the 435 districts in Congress, represented in Congress, each one represents about 750 to 800,000 people. And of those 435 districts, there are only about 65 that have a significant agricultural presence in them. So we have to get 218 votes to pass anything or to keep anything from getting passed in agriculture. And so it makes the coalition building very important. It also gives power to the skeptics who are constantly working to undermine us. Who are they? Well, they're groups from the far right, kind of the libertarian crowd that wants to reduce government spending in all kinds of ways. And they maybe don't have the courage to take on some of the big entitlements. And so they go after agriculture because there aren't many of us. They're also the kind of the wild-eyed redistributionists and environmentalists from the left who don't love, don't even like, are against our modern production agricultural sector. They're the ones that refer to all of agriculture as corporate agribusiness, right? And factory farms that just produce out the product with little regard to the consumers that they're caring for. They are literally biting the hand that feeds them.
But why is the Farm Bill vital?
This is why the Farm Bill is so important. The Farm Bill, you may or may not participate in a significant way. You may love the programs, or you may think the programs are an inefficiency built in the system. But one of the beautiful things about the Farm Bill is it brings us all together to fight these fights. And in the Farm Bill, we're fighting on relatively positive ground. This is trying to do something to support agriculture in the United States of America. It's our positive bill that we can all rally around, and we all need to rally around. But it greases the gears for the other big fights that we know, and I'll talk about them a little bit later in the presentation. There are other big fights that we have to be engaged in on the environment, on international trade, on rules and regulations around commerce, on environmental regulations, on taxes. And if we can't stick together and hang tough on bills like the Farm Bill, then we really run the risk of falling on these other one-off policies that affect every one of your businesses day in and day out.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We follow up, and based on some feedback and questions we've had from producers on some of the recent articles that we've done and talked about analyzing feedstuffs on a per unit of crude protein or energy that we're actually purchasing.
He's the host of SunUp's Cow-Calf Corner, Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State Beef Breeding Specialist.
We take a little closer look at what goes on in our cow herd, or individual cows for that matter, relative to their daily energy and crude protein requirements as they go through different stages of production. We always talk about in cow herds, there's two primary things that influence the nutritional requirements of cows, those being the sheer size or biomass or the mature weight of the cow, and then the level of milk production she actually gives. But I think it's worth mentioning the stage of production that she's actually at. As we'll talk about today, we'll see that has a pretty dramatic impact relative to that level of milk that she gives once she goes into lactation. It's important to think about what a cow actually needs, because if there's two things we can do to rob a cow-calf operation of profit potential, it's overfeeding and underfeeding. And so as we take a look at the 1,300-pound cow, normal weather, so we've not got climate influencing actual needs, making the assumption that we've got an ample supply of good quality water, and we know we're probably feeding some kind of a mineral supplement ad lib. The energy and crude protein requirements of a 1,300-pound cow in the middle third of pregnancy, there's actually 1.64 pounds of protein and about 11 pounds of energy in the form of TDN. Now, as we've discussed in recent weeks, cow, there's a good chance she's going to be able to meet those nutritional requirements on some kind of average quality hay, or still just some kind of a decent quality pasture. But as we look at that same cow and think about her going into the final trimester of pregnancy, when we've got some extra growth and development of a fetus going on inside of her, that same cow actually moves up to a 1.84 crude protein requirement each day, and the energy need goes up to 13.3. Now that's some increase. But when she actually calves and begins to milk, we now take a look at some numbers that when we really see that spike in the crude protein and energy requirements of that cow relative to the amount of milk that she gives. That cow, if she peaks out giving about 25 pounds of milk per day, those first 90 days post-calving, She's going to move up to 3.4 pounds of crude protein a day that she needs, and that energy requirement is going to spike up to 19.3. Now, that's at 25 pounds of milk per day at the peak of lactation. If that cow's giving 35 pounds of milk per day, she's actually going to need 4.2 pounds of crude protein and 22.2 pounds of energy. So through the normal ebb and flow of a production cycle, the same cow, based on how much milk she's genetically programmed to give, we see a lot of ebb and flow. We see some pretty serious spikes in what she actually needs. Why is this worth talking about this time of year? We want to take into account the stage of production we're at with our cow herd, when we're going to start calving. We know we'd like those cows at a body condition score 5 to 6. When they start calving, that's going to ensure that they've got the energy reserves that permit them to breed back quickly, calve again, and wean off a calf every 12 months.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The sound of aviation history being made. A Virgin Atlantic 787 from London landing in New York Tuesday, the first transatlantic flight powered by sustainable aviation fuel made from materials such as used cooking oils and agricultural wastes. Yes, it was just a demonstration flight. There's not yet a true sustainable aviation fuel industry, but as Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack tells audiences wherever he goes,
this is the future, and agriculture needs to be at the center of it.
Vilsack says ethanol in this country is about a 15-billion-gallon industry, but as to the potential market for sustainable aviation fuel, it's not 15 billion.
This is 36 billion gallons.
And Vilsack says as this new industry develops and scales up,
there are unlimited opportunities here.
Vilsack says a fully developed sustainable aviation fuel industry could result in creation of as many as 1 million rural jobs. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Thanks, Gary. Let's segue from aviation fuel to crop residue. Allie Nippert reports.
Grazing cattle on crop residue is something producers might have in their management plan. K-State Cow-Calf Extension Specialist Jason Warner discusses what producers can keep in mind this grazing season, how the crop performed correlates with the nutritional value it has for cattle.
Crop residues are a really valuable resource for our beef cattle producers that really can help extend the grazing season and reduce our feed costs. But one of the things that I think is a key important consideration, regardless if it's corn or grain sorghum or soybean residue, is that, you know, after harvest, the amount of forage, biomass that we have out there on that field, that's what we've got to start with, and that's all that we're going to have. And it's going to decrease in both quality and quantity as we leave those cattle out there longer. One thing that we want to keep in mind is that cattle are selective in terms of their grazing habit, and they're always going to consume or go after the most palatable crop components first.
Warner shares management solutions for when there could be too much grain on the ground.
If we're in a situation, if we've got a lot of down grain on the surface of the field, that certainly can create some risk, because when cattle rapidly consume a high level of grain and starch in their diet, that puts us at a greater risk for acidosis or founder. And we know that we can run into a number of different health challenges and potential losses with cattle, of course, when we're in that type of a situation. And so some things we would want to keep in mind there that can potentially be beneficial would be providing some other supplemental hay or some feed to help decrease the amount of grain that those cattle are going to consume. Another approach can be just simply supplementing grain or milo to those cattle prior to turning them out to just increase their ability to be able to utilize that starch in that grain without having any negative associated effects on starch digestion.
He explains what supplementation might be needed for grazing crop residue.
What we want to keep in mind is that where our forage quality and our quantity decreases over time, the need for supplementation will increase, and particularly in the case of spring calving cows, as they get closer to calving later on, if we're thinking about calving in maybe January or February. Where I think producers have ran into challenges in the past is we've left cattle out on corn stalks too long, and we've taken too much residue off. We force those cattle down to graze into the stalk or the stem of the plant, and as a result, our forage quality drops, and we're not able to maintain weight and body condition score on those animals.
That was Kansas State University Cow-Calf Extension Specialist Jason Warner on the benefits and concerns of grazing crop residue fields. This management practice can be beneficial financially for producers, but they need to make sure their cattle are receiving adequate nutrition. I'm Allie Nippert.
Thanks, Allie. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It seems more and more people are telling us that they are done with artificial Christmas trees. They want a real tree.
I think the nostalgia of a real tree is one thing, and the smell of it.
It's more fun.
Yeah, you feel more connected to the land.
I don't know. It doesn't feel like Christmas if it's a fake tree.
And according to Tim O'Connor with the National Christmas Tree Association,
those families are choosing real Christmas trees because they match up with their values.
And more younger people just starting their own families are getting their trees at family-owned Christmas tree farms,
where they can meet the family, they can see that growing a real tree is a sustainable business. That matches up with the values of this younger generation.
Which is why Tim O'Connor says Christmas tree growers are very optimistic about the future of the industry. They're planting more trees now, which will be ready for sale in about 10 years. And most growers believe
those trees will hit the market with a growing number of buyers looking for them.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.